Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and here today with me is Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky College of Law. Professor Douglas specializes in electoral law and has written extensively, especially on Twitter, but also in other places, about electoral law, both in Kentucky and in the rest of the country. And I highly recommend that you follow his Twitter feed. Josh, what is your Twitter feed, by the way?
Joshua A. Douglas.
So I heartily recommend that you guys take a listen to it. Anyway, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to chat.
Well, it's a delight to have you on. So I began to follow you I believe now it was May, when we here in Kentucky surprisingly became an epicenter for conversations about voter fraud, voter suppression, making voting as open as possible, or sort of how voting restrictions affected turnout and so forth. And that was the Kentucky Democratic primary, which was run between Charles Brooker on the one side and Amy McGrath on the other. I guess just to start off with, what do you remember about that period, and how did we sort of weirdly become this epicenter without really meaning to be or really deserving to be, but this place where people were talking about voter suppression in the context of Kentucky?
Yeah, this was the hashtag all eyes on Kentucky that went viral. And it's a great example of disinformation coming from the left, really. You know, we often hear about misinformation and disinformation coming from the right with so-called fake news. But this is an example of misinformation by several celebrities and others with high Twitter accounts and high profile names who were watching what was happening in Kentucky and making a big deal about it without realizing and understanding the local context. So, you know, the big storyline was that Louisville, a city of 600,000 and the largest community of minority voters in the state, was going to have only one voting location for those 600,000 voters. And, you know, if you hear that, you think, my goodness, that's shocking. And how could that possibly be? And there's something wrong. That's voter suppression, no question. Of course, that wasn't the truth of the matter in terms of how many voters were going to be showing up and what the voting opportunities were. But it's a storyline that, you know, look at Kentucky. It's all often thought of as kind of backwards and slow moving. And it does have some of the most restrictive voting laws in the country. And so this played into that narrative that there were just going to be one voting location for the entire city of Louisville.
Right. And I found it really fascinating, too, that I think people correctly identified that the fact that Kentucky closes its polls at 6 p.m. Does, in fact, result in a lot of voter suppression without sort of understanding the history of why that's the case in Kentucky, which is that it has to do so with the fact that bars are closed or bars used to be closed on election day in Kentucky. And so you had, bar owners advocated for the The history of it is all quite bizarre and does result in a degree of voter suppression, but the reality was vastly more complex than sort of the firestorm that overtook Kentucky during this election.
It, it certainly was. And so, you had LeBron James and you had Hillary Clinton tweeting with this hashtag all eyes on Kentucky, suggesting that there was going to be massive voter suppression. And yet, I agree with you that Kentucky's laws are set up to make it difficult for many people to vote. But the way in which that May 2020 primary was held with almost everyone voting by mail, which is why we knew there weren't going to be 600,000 people showing up in Louisville, was just false. I mean, it was focused on the wrong things. And what do we see on that voting day? Over I think statewide, 80% of voters cast a ballot via absentee ballot in that primary. And lines were no longer than 5 minutes throughout the entire day in Louisville, with the exception of what happened at the very end. There's an issue with the poll closing because of traffic. And so, what the real concern actually wasn't that the polls are going to be so bombarded that there's going to be massive lines like we saw in Georgia. The issue was, is it too difficult for someone who doesn't live near the convention center where the polling place was to travel there. I was someone who thought we should have more than one polling location, as were most of the people in the Secretary of State's office and State Board of Elections. This was a local decision by the local Louisville City Clerk, Jefferson County Clerk. But the kind of suppression was just not as stark as what was feared.
Right. And in fact, even at that very end, when the convention center was closing and dramatically, and one of Joe Zonka, for example, is a friend of mine. And so he was there in the television and as the doors were slamming shut. There was confusion about that because in Kentucky state voting law, anybody who is in line at 6 o'clock is permitted to vote. But part of the problem with the convention center was that there were no identifiable lines at 6 o'clock, right? And I think the Booker campaign argued that the traffic constituted a line. And so that there was confusion with that. But again, and the other thing,
all those people were allowed to vote, by the way, right? I mean, yeah. So the Booker campaign brought a suit. The judge was right there. The judge extended the polling hours for those people who were there. And, you know, the process worked in terms of at least the rules were set that the specific way in which that primary was run did not cause that massive voter suppression that the All Eyes in Kentucky hashtag was fearing. Not to say there was no voter suppression, and indirectly, it is too difficult to vote in this state, but that was not a good example of it.
Right, right. And I think also, Louisville was the focus of this because it's such a large, it's sort of the largest city and it has the largest minority population. I wagered at the time, and I never saw good data on this, that the reduction to one polling, basically, not quite exactly, but basically one polling place per county, probably had a greater impact in some of the more remote counties in eastern Kentucky, where it's like literally difficult to get to the one polling place just because of the way that the terrain works. And I've never seen any data on exactly how that played out, but it is a geographic state in that sense.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I will say that you have to understand the one polling place per county in conjunction with for the first time ever, anyone could vote via absentee ballot with no excuse, with a massive campaign to try to convince people to vote via absentee ballot on both sides of the aisle. And so, like I said, over 80% of Kentucky voters, or maybe just about 80% in that primary, did vote by mail. And we made it relatively easy. In fact, I would say very easy to vote by mail in Kentucky in that primary. And so, yes, I think it's concerning to have only one location for people to go if people are, for whatever reason, they want to physically cast their vote in person. But at the same time, we have to understand that the trade-off was making it far easier than ever before to vote via absentee ballot.
Right. So with that, framing that as sort of the local political trauma associated with voting rights and voting enablement and so forth, since that point, there has been lots of discussion about how to reform the voting process in Kentucky, and there's even been some legislation. Now, to give a little context, Kentucky currently has a Democratic governor, but Republican supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. And so, despite that, it is my impression, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, that Kentucky remains a bit of an outlier in terms of the direction in which voting legislation is moving in the state, right? That, in fact, we do not seem to be getting more restrictive in Kentucky as, and we'll talk about this later, as states like Georgia and other states that have Republican-dominated legislatures are moving with respect to voting rights.
That's right. And I think that's a really important context, because when you hear people discuss the Georgia law and how it's easier to vote in Georgia even after this suppressive law that was passed as compared to Kentucky, that's asking the wrong question, because you're not thinking about what the starting place is, and you're not thinking about the local communities and the needs of the local communities and the expectations of how people vote in these various locations. And while a lot of states are going backward and making it harder to vote and doing so in a very partisan way, Kentucky passed a new law which has some good things for both sides, essentially. Now, I was privileged to be part of some of the conversations about this bill. And what I can tell you is that amazingly, the discussion was really about what makes the most sense for both access and integrity. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the main lessons that should come out of Kentucky is that those two things, making it easier to vote and also making sure the system is free of fraud, are not mutually exclusive. You can do things, and Kentucky has a couple specific things that we just passed that do both, even at the same time. So one quick example, the online portal to request an absentee ballot is both access enhancing, makes it easier for people to request their ballot, but it also enhances integrity because the state can track every single absentee ballot through the system, especially because the law also requires barcodes on every mail-in ballot. Now, the law doesn't go anywhere near as far as I want with respect to access, but if you think about the starting place, we made it easier, mildly, but still easier to vote, while at the same time, because it was a larger package of reforms, short out integrity, or at least perceived integrity. And that's how you got so many Republicans to the table as well.
Now, is there any prospect, do you think, sort of other states will pay attention to what's going on here with respect to this connection between integrity and access? And, you know, will adopt similar things? Or are we already seeing sort of not necessarily copycat, but a bunch of different states innovating at the same time with respect to voting access?
Well, the idealist in me hopes that the national news Kentucky made for the good reason, and, you know, we got right up in the New York Times and CNN and a handful of other places. My hope is that people see what's possible, and I think there's some lessons to be learned from how Kentucky went about the process. The skeptic in me recognizes that in swing states where there's a perception that higher turnout is going to basically help Democrats, that, you know, we're seeing more and more partisan-based laws that don't do both things. And, you know, even the Georgia law has a couple of good things in it in enhancing access a little bit. But again, you have to think about it in terms of the starting place as compared to Kentucky. And, you know, Kentucky is in some ways unique for two reasons in terms of how we were able to get bipartisan positive reform. One is that Republicans did so well in 2020, even with enhanced access, that they're basically not afraid of making it easier to vote. They're not afraid they're going to lose. And we were already starting from, you know, one of the worst places in the country in terms of access to the ballot box. So when you start towards the bottom, the only way to go is up, and you're able to get Republicans to not be as concerned about their at least perception of the partisan effects. Now, I don't buy this making it easier to vote necessarily helps Democrats' rationale. Just the numbers don't play it out. I mean, Republicans had an extremely good year in 2020, with the exception of the very top of the ticket, where they had a historically unpopular incumbent president lose. But besides that, Republicans did quite well in 2020 in lots of states. And so I just don't buy that higher turnout necessarily means more Democratic gains. But I think in the swing states, there is that perception. We don't have that here just because it's such a supermajority, at least in the legislature.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually going to be my next question, which was why, in your view, like, how is it that that particular understanding of voter access has taken hold? Because I know on the Democratic side, things have changed a little bit, right? And just in the last couple of months, and this, well, wow, maybe it's just not ratcheting up numbers always benefits the Democrats. But on the Republican side, there doesn't seem to have been any recognition. There seems to have been little recognition that, you know, there are communities out there that you can find at higher rates of voting that are going to vote Republican, right? So that it's not this sort of linear relationship between turnout and Democratic voting, right? Is that just an artifact of Trump? Or, I mean, what is your thinking on that?
Yeah, maybe it's not. I mean, well, I think it predates Trump probably in terms of this perception. You know, we've been having these debates about access versus integrity, you know, at least since 2000 and the presidential election of Bush v. Gore. But, you know, even earlier than that, that's really when it came to the forefront that we saw that voting rules can have such a big outcome on the election. Of course, you know, that election came down to one state, Florida, and 537 votes in that state. So, you know, in terms of, you know, that's sort of a needle in the haystack, likelihood to happen again is pretty small. And so, you know, these things can make a difference on the margins and certainly make a difference for certain groups to be able to vote. But I'm not as convinced that they will actually make a difference in terms of electoral outcomes, except for when you have a very, very close election. But again, I think the politics were a little bit easier for Republicans here because they had such a large supermajority. But I also think that there's something else going on here in Kentucky, and that's that the signals from the leaders were positive. And I got to give a lot of credit to Secretary of State Michael Adams, who I was privileged to serve on his transition team when he first won election. And, you know, when he asked me to serve on the transition team, I said, you know, there are two kinds of secretaries of state. There are those who see themselves as the partisan they ran as in the office as well. And, you know, the best example would be Georgia Secretary of State, prior Georgia Secretary of State, now governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, who literally used his office to make it easier for him to win election in the 2018 gubernatorial race. And then compare that to secretaries of state in places like Michigan, Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, in Ohio, Frank LaRose, a Republican, who you know have their partisan viewpoints, but take their partisan hats off when they're doing the official duties of their office. And I said to Secretary Adams, you know, I only serve on your transition team if you tell me that that's the kind of secretary you plan to be. And he said that is. And I think he's been that way by and large. You know, everyone has their own partisanship and sometimes, you know, he slips into it. But I think most of the time in his official duties, his concern has been dual, protect the voters and protect the voting system. And that message is vastly different than what you get from a lot of these politicians in other states that are talking about, you know, essentially all the massive fraud that's going on. You know, there isn't massive fraud. And so let's admit it. Let's create common sense measures that make it so the fraud won't happen or is less likely to happen, that don't harm voters at the same time. But also let's focus on the voter experience. And that the signal from the top here in Kentucky, I think, is very different than what we had in a lot of other states.
Right. And I mean, it's worth sort of, again, rewinding to, well, not simply the May primary, but also the November general, how little conflict there was in Kentucky about how the election was going to go down before it actually happened, right? I mean, the concern was all imported from external sources because it was a bipartisan process with the governor signing on and, you know, the Jefferson County clerk and the Secretary of State and so forth, right? So there was sort of bipartisan agreement that this was the best way to undertake an election in a really difficult situation.
Absolutely. And the other thing to note kind of behind the scenes is that it was not only those actors, but it was additional people like the Kentucky Clerks Association, which is a body that represents the 120 county clerks. They're the ones on the ground who actually run the election, right? Who know what it takes. And so, you know, they had a large seat at the table in terms of helping to explain, here's what we need to do to make this thing work. You know, I value that type of conversation, that experience a lot because, you know, legislators don't know. Yeah, they ran an election. So maybe, you know, a lot of them think they're election experts because they ran their campaigns, but they're not, right? It's these county clerks and the people in their offices, in addition to the State Board of Elections. The executive director, Jared Deering, and the deputy, who is also and it's required to be bipartisan on the state board, as well as the 8 members, I think, who are on the state board, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans. And so, you know, there's bipartisanship built into the process. And those people had a seat at the table when crafting the rules for the May primary, the November election, and now this new bill that just passed. I had the privilege of being part of the conversations as well. And I like to think that they actually did listen to an election law specialist, at least in some of these aspects. And when you have those kinds of voices, you get a very different kind of legislation than when you just have the partisan legislators who's, you know, really are into, you know, the self-interest of themselves and their parties.
Right, so let's leave Kentucky behind and then shift over to Georgia, right? Which is the one that has captured all of the attention, and this is an area which is, you know, as you suggested, the exact opposite of Kentucky with respect to the effect of voting regulations on outcomes, or what we expect to see, right?
So we have an extraordinarily narrow decision in the Georgia presidential race. We have two not quite as narrow, but still pretty narrow results in the two Senate races that happened there that are obviously enormously consequential for governance. So from your experience and your research with respect to electoral law, I mean, what are we going to see as an impact of the new Georgia law on the Georgia electorate? I mean, what direction is this going to push, right? Is it going to be very marginal, but it make that marginal really matter because Georgia is so closely divided? What is the impact of restrictions like the ones that, or of new regimes like the one that has been installed in Georgia?
So it's a really interesting question, right? Because on the one hand, the various measures, you know, shortening the absentee balloting timeline for when people can request an absentee ballot, limiting where drop boxes can be to drop off your ballot and the hours that they're available. Those things, you know, you would think are going to impact certain communities. At least that was certainly the impetus for the law, surely. And so on the one hand, you might think it might be harder for certain communities, African-Americans in inner cities like Atlanta, to vote. You know, at the same time, sometimes you see a backlash because of the amount of attention that's been placed on this law that, you know, people who, you know, otherwise might be deterred by having a harder time getting to the drop box might actually, you know, come out in further droves, essentially to prove them wrong. So I think it's really hard to predict what the electoral outcome is going to be. But here's where I think we need to focus our attention, which is why should we make it harder for people to vote, especially when they exercised their right to vote and you didn't like the outcome and so now you're placing further barriers. So to me, whether it has a tangible impact on results or even turnout is much less of a question. I mean, it's concerning, but it's not the right question to be asking. The right question is, how do we conceive of our democracy? Do we conceive of it as one where everyone has a fair, equal say to determine who makes policy for us? And are we going to erect unnecessary barriers to doing so, especially in retaliation for what the voters did? And, you know, Republicans in Georgia, the ones who voted for this law, by and large, are afraid of the voters. Just like bringing it back to our home state, Mitch McConnell, in opposing expansions of the ballot, is afraid of the voters. Other Republicans are not afraid of the voters. And those Republicans, just like the Democrats who believe that, are, in my view, pro-democracy. And the Georgia law exemplifies anti-democracy. Even if it's easier to vote in Georgia than in other states, the state is moving backwards in access for no good reason.
Now, I wonder if you've been paying attention to, or if you have been paying attention to, and if you've been troubled. Over the past month or so, I've sort of detected, and other people have detected, a shift. And so you're finding in places like the National Review and so forth that the argument has less been sort of the common voter fraud explanation for why voting needs to be restricted. And instead, there's almost been, and this has been in a couple of significant areas, not just on Twitter, in fact, it is a good idea to make it harder to vote, right? Because you get a better electorate when you make it harder, because reasons, right? You get a better electorate, something along those lines, but that in fact, we ought not to take steps to make things easier to vote just because that's not necessarily what democracy is about. I suppose, do you think that's going to catch on? Have you found that particularly troubling, or have you seen any other examples of that?
I think it's extremely troubling. Yeah, I heard this directly from our junior senator in Kentucky, Rand Paul. He came to the law school many years ago, maybe 2012 or 2014, and I was actually the sort of questioner and moderator of the conversation with him. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, it shouldn't be easy to vote. People should get off their butts. That was the quote. It shouldn't be easy to vote. People should get off their butts. And I was flabbergasted because, you know, we live under a concept of a Declaration of Independence, which says that we are governed, we are legitimate, our democracy is legitimate based on the consent of the governed. And, you know, the governed isn't just who we think, you know, who we agree with. The governed is all of us. You know, so this is not a new concept. You also hear this nonsense of, well, we're, you know, we're a republic, not a democracy, which of course, you know, people who say that don't really know what they're talking about, because actually we're both. And those two things are synonymous in our modern world. There's no difference between we are a democratic republic. We elect people to then represent our views and enact policies as we wish. And so I think it's of that same mindset. I find it extremely concerning. It's not new, but maybe it's a new tact now that they can't find any evidence of actual fraud. Just the myth out there, perhaps this is another talking point. But I think it's extremely concerning. And, you know, I don't care. It simply shouldn't be hard for us to do the most fundamental thing in our democracy. And people will always say, you know, well, if we, you know, we get to voter ID, well, you need an ID to go buy liquor. Actually, you don't. There's always workarounds. You need an ID to go buy Sudafed. Actually, you don't. The pharmacist can take other measures to sell you Sudafed. You need an ID to get on a plane. Well, no. TSA has workarounds. Also, none of those things are fundamental rights. And I don't know how many, you know, poor people who don't have the ability to get an ID are getting on planes.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, so this... this whole notion is nonsense, but it is another talking point that we're hearing more and more.
Just on that point, the whole we are a republic, not a democracy. Among political scientists, there is no way to generate audible eye rolls more rapidly than to say that. And I think probably there are so many undergraduates who have thought that that's like the critical thing that they can say in an undergraduate course, and the professor just falls apart when they say that. So,
yeah. In the law school, it's the judges never make law concept. Of course they do. They always do. The most conservative originalist judge makes law, in quotes, because they have to interpret things that don't have a clear meaning. And so you've got to figure out, what does this word mean in the Constitution or in a statute? That's making law. So everyone does it. Of course, you know, there's more than other than others, but that's a similar thing in the law school.
Right. So I guess really to sort of close out here, what do you make of the corporate pushback campaign with respect to the Georgia law, right? I mean, I was really surprised when Major League Baseball stepped up and shifted the All-Star game out of Georgia. But it seems like there's almost a corporate consensus around this now. And so, I mean, have any of these steps surprised you? And what do you make of them? What kind of impact do you think that they're going to have?
So first off, I'm a huge baseball fan. So when Major League Baseball got involved, it was sort of like my worlds were colliding because, you know, I pay a huge attention to baseball, pay a huge attention to voting rights, and now the two things are intersecting. So I'm not surprised, though, by this because, you know, corporations have a long history of constitutional development. There's a great book by a professor out of UCLA, Adam Winkler, called We the Corporations, which traces the history of constitutional rights as corporate rights. And so this is another step in that front. And, you know, corporations were given greater ability to make political donations, not directly to candidates, but to outside organizations and to engage in electoral advocacy. In the 2010 Citizens United case, it's pretty ironic to me that you have some politicians say, you know, corporations shouldn't be involved in politics while they're, you know, asking for the next donation to their super PAC. But, you know, I think what this underscores is that the project of democracy requires a whole community to be engaged in reevaluating and reforming itself. And especially after the insurrection on January 6th, where you saw, you know, the biggest attack on our democracy since at least the Civil War, you need everyone. You need the leaders and the politicians, but you need the local election clerks and you need the poll workers, and you need the other types of actors in our society. And that includes nonprofit advocacy organizations, but it also includes corporations because they're such an important player in our society. So I wasn't surprised, and I'm hopeful that it can make a difference.
All right. Well, Joshua, this has been fantastic, and I very much appreciate you coming on. It's been a delight to have you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. And also, I want to thank our listeners for joining us today, and we'll hopefully in the future bring you more good content like this. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.